Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Loading up Big Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P futures, after down day yesterday, are down another 22. NASDAQ down 181. Yesterday, just as a point of review, the S&P was down 55. NASDAQ down 271. So actually, the NASDAQ 100 was down 379. That's the future that we watch during the day. That's what the futures and that's what the QQQs are based on. So if you look on your CNBC now, you'll see two of them up there. You'll see the NASDAQ and you'll see the NASDAQ 100. Well, NASDAQ 100 is the one that actually trades. If you trade the QQQ, that's the one you're getting. Kevin's going to be a little bit delayed here, so you got to put up with Andrew and me for a little bit. Andrew, I was on Joel and his buddy Josh. They're actually Brent. Josh is their producer. Their podcast yesterday, and it's always interesting. And they were asking me, you know, a bunch of questions, and some of them were pretty good. And I think, you know, maybe we could take a minute to talk about them. You know, his buddy Brent really is involved, wants to know about the economics of the stuff that's going on. And they mostly just talk, you know, individual stocks with people, which is, you know, everybody knows that I don't want to do. And by the way, I really shouldn't be doing and don't because of all my registrations. And, you know, they were saying, what if you had money today, where would you put it in the market and so forth? And I said, well, today is a tricky one. Plus, I don't really want to give that kind of advice if I don't know somebody's portfolio or I know the person. I said, but at the beginning of the year, what we did, we had a significant amount of cash because we had made money on some puts on stuff that went down. Okay, so even though people might have had some stocks or whatever that had gone down in price, so they're down on, you know, they had a stock that was 80 and went down to 70. Well, we maybe had the 78 puts or something and made money. Anyway, there was a lot of cash we had. So my brother Dan and I and a couple other guys, we said, okay, what are we going to put the stuff in? And oil, and I was not clairvoyant enough to know that there was going to be a war, that Trump was going to start a war. You know, I don't have inside information, and I don't see the future. But my brother said, you know, every time oil gets down below $60, something always happens to drive it to 100, and when it gets to 100, it's always going to go to 150, and it never does. So he said this XLE, which is the piece of the S&P 500, it's the of all the oil companies, he said, why don't we put some in there, and we have it protected, and we'll also maybe the XLV, which is the healthcare piece of the S&P, which no matter what seems to get income, right? So we wasn't like, you know, we're going on the world tour and saying, boy, these are our picks or anything like that, but they seem like they were reasonable at the time, and in fact, in the 8 months, have really worked out very well. Now, again, part of that was we had them protected a couple times. They went down, and we didn't lose that much, and so, I mean, we do it our normal way. It's not like we pile into this thing and say, boy, I'm a genius. Don't do anything. Just let it go up. You know, I wish it was that way, but it's not. Some people would tell you that it is. Well, I wouldn't believe them if I were you. But anyway, I said, but right now, both of them have done very well. And oil, is, as of yesterday, is $90. So it may have a little bit more to run because some of the people that are in this index, I mean, it's the big companies, but it's also some of the big companies like Chevron and Exxon. Those guys also have refineries. You know, so right now, the money appears to be being made in the refinery end. Because when you look at oil, there's two things you need to look at. Okay, we look at the price of oil, the price of gasoline, and the price of diesel. Now, that's the crack spread, because when you refine oil, you're going to get gasoline, you're going to get diesel, which is the same thing as heating oil. You're going to get gasoline, you're going to get heating oil slash diesel. Then you get a bunch of other stuff. You know, you get some heavy oil, you get some paraffins, you get all that kind of crap. And you get stuff you make plastic out of, okay? But by and large, you're getting a gasoline and heating oil. And sometimes the price of oil is at a price where the price of gasoline and heating oil don't leave much in the middle, that the refineries are very, very competitive. So the crack spread would be small. Because that's called the crack spread. The spread before you crack the oil and after you crack the oil. And which is different than the soybeans, which is the crush. There's the soybeans and then there's the soybean oil and soybean meal. That's called the crush, but the oil is the crack. But right now, I think as Carl mentioned the other day, it's almost like a record difference between the price of oil and the price of diesel. So the refineries right now are doing exceptionally well. Sometimes they don't, but now they are. So the multi-integrated companies, the Chevrons, Exxon, the people that have the oil that they're digging out of the ground, and that do the refineries, and maybe even have the gas stations, those are the guys that appear to be doing the best right now, especially if there's refineries involved. The guy who's probably doing the best is Trump's buddy who grabbed the heavy oil refineries on the Gulf Coast out of bankruptcy miraculously 2 or 3 weeks before Trump invaded or whatever he did to Venezuela. Now all of a sudden we have this 100-year deal with those guys. First of all, we couldn't wait to get those people out of office, and these are the same people, just the understudies of the guys he pulled out of there. Okay, so I'm not a big... But now they sign up. It's not even a legitimate government. But he signs a 100-year deal. How do you sign a 100-year deal with a government that's not even elected or legitimate? I mean, I guess you can pull it off if you want to, and say what you want to say. But anyway, the crux of what those guys were asking yesterday is, you know, what's it like to manage money right now? And I said, well, there's always something. I mean, there's a war, there's not a war, there's the Fed. That's what makes the business challenging and fun. There's always something. Or you go through long periods of nothing. I mean, when Obama was in office, and other people, you could go a year without a 1% move during the day. Now, that's great if you're writing calls and stuff, or if you're doing covered straddle rights or things like that. I mean, there's a strategy that's perfect for that. But you never really know what's going to happen tomorrow. You can sure say what happened last month. It's why when you hear people go, if you just would have got in this one, well, yeah. What about if I could read tomorrow's newspaper today, I could do pretty well. I think so. Anyway, I said I've never seen so many balls in the air. I mean, in the last 10 days, or let's say 3 weeks, we've had the yen sneak up, and there's more to this. It's all is so tied together. I mean, yesterday, unbelievably, Trump came out with some missive that since the UK isn't spending enough on military, we're going to decide that we think the Falkland Islands belong to Argentina and not Britain. And I'm like, what are you doing? And what is that supposed to drive everybody's attention away from Epstein or all the other crap? I don't know. But anyway, I'm sitting there. Last I checked, we owe the Brits $970 billion or something. I mean, that's kind of a lot. Matter of fact, I'll get the exact number here if I'm going to pop it out. When the yen, with the price of oil here at $90, the Japanese, and why I keep harping on the Japanese is because we owe them $1.1 trillion. All right, so they're having trouble buying oil at this price, and they have to buy oil in dollars. I mean, I know I say this all the time, but this is something serious. They buy oil in dollars. Okay, so they've got to take their yen, turn it into dollars, and then go buy the oil. I mean, maybe there's some barter someplace, but by and large, that's what they have to do. So the price of oil is going up, and oh, by the way, the price of their dollar is going down. So they have issues. So they were essentially selling some treasuries to buy our to uh, to be able to buy the yen, to keep the yen under 160, which is kind of their target price. Okay, so then we, meaning our Secretary of the Treasury, came out a few weeks ago and bought a whole bunch of yen. He used euro dollars, but he basically bought it and drove it from 163, which was way above the price that they get upset with, and drove it down to 157. Right, well, now it's right back to 160. So now, is he going to do this again? And when he did, he drove gold prices up, he drove silver prices up. And then 2 weeks ago, he said, we're going to buy long-term bonds because the long-term bond number was getting to 4.4. Just when I say long-term, the 10-year, 4.5. Well, now it's 4.8. So it's higher than he did it the first time. So every day when I come in, somewhere in the morning, all of a sudden I'm going to see this jolt in bonds going down and maybe gold or silver moving, which we have big positions in for a lot of people. All of a sudden, this is going to be a move based on what this guy does today. And I know it's going to be telegraphed. Other people are going to know it before I know it. So it's interesting. Andrew, what I just said, do you have any idea? Does anybody have an idea? Japan, we owe as of June, we owe Japan $1.1 trillion, and we owe the United Kingdom $940 billion. We owe China $663, Belgium $482, and here's one. We owe Canada $460, even though we hate Canadians. But we owe them $460 billion. Andrew, what does anybody make of this? If you didn't hear it on the show, does anybody talk about any of this stuff anywhere you go?
Honestly, no. This is really the first time I'm hearing a lot of this. I generally hear about, how we are maybe morally in debt to other countries. But very little am I hearing about the actual monetary debt do we owe them.
Well, if you were to ask, you're going to a big party Friday night, if you were to ask, anybody hear about the fact that we're 40 trillion, now we're almost 40 trillion, 100 billion in debt? Would anybody be able to say, by the way, who do we owe? Does anybody have any idea or even care?
Oh, yeah, no idea. Like, we can definitely say, absolutely, we are certainly in debt, but no ideas on who that is going to.
Interesting. Is that everybody or just, the guys you went to school with, or a lot of them are, the artsy types. You guys are into, plays and those kinds of things and doing some AI stuff and everything. But is that general or, because we're up to, it, 2 weeks ago was the number that was all over the radio and TV that we had surpassed $40 trillion in debt. Well, now we're past $40 trillion, 105. So in the last 2 weeks, we're up another $105 billion. And I'm going to say that probably, if I take a stab here, I'd say that out of the $40 trillion, what do we owe people overseas? Grand total, 92, something like that. No, about 10 is for foreign. So I think it's more than that, actually. I think it's more like 40%, but these guys claim it's 9.2 trillion on this particular one. Then there's some other stuff here, but it's a lot. It's somewhere between 25 and 40. I've heard as much as 40%, but I think it might be down from that a little bit. But plus, I don't think Saudi Arabia, there's stuff that's not counted on here, which I don't know the details of, but it's not anything that anybody can really worry themselves. I was on Joan Esposito a few years ago, and she said to me, I don't have any debt. A lot of people don't have any debt. And I said, Joan, you're a taxpayer, right? And she goes, yeah, well, the debt per taxpayer in a national debt is $361,000. She goes, thanks for ruining my day. There's nothing you can do about it, so I guess why think about it? I guess it's really the way. Why not?
Going back to your question of, so I'm in a very specific spot where, speaking for myself here, I kind of only, pay attention to the headlines. I personally, other than this here, work from home, so I'm not always seeing what's going on in the world, essentially. I can get a little isolated sometimes in terms of the bigger news.
I think that generally happens to everybody who works at home.
Probably not. Again, I think it's just kind of a me thing. Like, my problem is, like, I always start every morning I start out with the news, and then I go into, like, an audiobook or something. You know, so that's why I'm not always up to date on everything. But I've always been that way. I've always been, like, personally, like, I don't know if I'd say, like, an old school person. Like, I don't know. I just never really, like, have been super into keeping up with the modern topics and everything. But at least going back to the debt question, or the thoughts about debt, yeah, I mean, like, I would say what I can more confidently say about, you know, broader people, like, in my community and who I speak to and everything, is that, I mean, yeah, like, none of us have, like, any idea what's going on with, like, you know, national debt and greater things like that. It's like, basically, the general consensus for people my age is student debt and rent and basically, like, I wouldn't say day-to-day, you know, but I mean, you know, like, our just general expenses, like...
Well, how much of a jolt is it when people reach their 26th birthday and all of a sudden you're off the parents' hospitalization?
Well, I am a month away from finding out, so...
Well, it's got to be a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think people are going to settle for stuff that's a lot... They're probably going to get the cheapest because you're bulletproof at age 26. And you're going to have all kinds of deductibles and copays in there that I'm sure was not in your parents' policy. Or at least not as many. I mean, it's kind of a jolt, I think, or it's going to be. If something happens to you and you actually have to go in the emergency room, then... You know, hopefully it's for, you know, something happened in a softball game that they easily fix. But even then, it's going to be $8,000-$10,000. I mean, sometimes it's really comforting to not know some of this stuff. It sort of really is. What would you say, I mean, your guys, I'll generalize here because I know several of your group. And all these guys all went to Columbia. And Professor Eric's going to be on later. Second half hour, and he was a professor there, so we'll probably talk a little bit about it with him. Guys are coming out, they've got some debt. You know, it's probably not the same amount of debt as if you went to Michigan or someplace or Northwestern, but you got some. You're in a area where you know, a lot of people are into media and those kinds of things, and media is not exactly paying people through the nose. As a matter of fact, they're laying off people in some areas. Certainly in a sports area they are. So everybody, while you're trying to do something you're trained for, a lot of people seem to have another job someplace, right? And the other job someplace is, you know, it's fast food, it's something, right?
Yeah.
Well, the prices that are moving on up to the upside, what is that doing to everybody? I mean, how many people can actually make enough to have their own apartment, maybe have a car payment, and even think about, you know, getting married and getting a house? I'm going to say nobody, unless you got parents' money.
Yeah, that... I mean, honestly, yeah, going to Columbia, it was pretty obvious of, like, who is there... essentially, who's there on parents' money and, you know, who is, like, actually getting the loans and everything. I mean, yeah, like, I don't know, when it comes to the, again, like, general group of people my age and around that, like, I think the main thing that I don't get that how people do it is, like, not necessarily vacations, but just, like, oh, yeah, like, I'm going to go, you know, a state over for a week. You know, I'm, like, going to go to Missouri for the week. Like, I know plenty of friends who do that kind of often. And my mind is always, like, you know, traveling expenses are one thing. It's not like, you know, you're going on a flight and maybe it's just like a day road trip or whatever. But I'm like, how are you affording to take that time off? Like, and by no means would I be, you know, like, screwed over if I took a week off or whatever. But it just seems to happen so frequently.
Well, look at the people. People going to Europe.
Yeah,
for 2 and 3 and 4 weeks, and I guess it's a different world. Before you on the board, we had girl Maddie. She went to Loyola. Very nice, pretty girl. She was gonna be like 5'10", 5'11". So we had guy Maddie, Matt Weber, and we had girl Maddie. Maddie, I forget what her last name was. But I'd pick her up every morning, and she was, you know, terrific. So it was one day, We're in the driving in. Of course, you know, I'm driving in with a 18-year-old, which is weird. But she's she goes, well, you know, my girlfriend, she's going on a trip, and she had a birds and the bees conversation with her dad. And I'm going, well, I don't know if I want to hear this one. But then she goes, oh, no, don't worry about that. We got that all figured out. And I'm going, well, congratulations. she goes, she's going to Loyola and getting these loans. And I don't know, her dad was a high school teacher or something up in Michigan. And she's going to be a teacher. So he basically went through all her finances, and he said, you know, when you're 43, you'll have this all paid off if you basically come back home and teach here and, you know, you get these kind of raises and so forth. Evidently, he did a real nice workup for her. And so she goes, yeah, we're going on spring break. And I go, well, her dad just told her how broke she was. And she goes, it's a whole different mindset. And she's telling me, she goes, what's the difference if you're out of debt in January when you're 43 or February? What's the difference? She might as well go on vacation and enjoy herself. She might not last to 43. And I'm going, well, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, in my generation, if you owed somebody something or you needed to save up for beer in the next semester, you for sure worked over Christmas if you could, because it was a small enough number you could actually get there. You know, when I worked over Christmas at the public schools, a lot of times I came home on break and I got another week. Well, that I never once in 4 years had to say, hey, Ma, give me $20 for beer. I mean, I never had to do that, which I thought was pretty nice. I'm sure she did too. But these were small numbers that you could control. I mean, I don't know what I'd do if you know, I went to some school where it was all in $100,000, and in the summer I could make $2,500. I mean, what is that? Talk about a pimple on the ass of an elephant, right? I mean, it's better than nothing, but it sure as hell isn't. I mean, I could have, even if I didn't get any money from my parents for tuition, I'll bet I was fortunate enough I was working at the school board, I'll bet I could have come out of school with, I don't know if I'd have worked in the dining hall or something, I bet I could have come out of school with maybe $4,000 in debt. Maybe. $4,500, something like that. That's a lot different than, you know, whatever, yeah. $250 oh, yeah. or something. I mean, it's not even close. Even though, you know, money was... Plus, you could... I mean, there were people that were making as much back then as you guys are making in the fast food joints. You know, if you've got a... Well, I went on a school board, I wasn't. You know, but what the hell was I making there? You know, $5 an hour, but it was 1970, for God's sake. So I don't even know what that would be, you know, today. But I just... You wonder if the... you know, who exactly is piling out of school with this kind of debt and is making the $150,000 you need to live, pay the stuff off. I mean, I don't know how many people are making that kind of money coming out of school, unless you're in very... But hey, we talk a lot about the AI stuff, and you do a lot of stuff with AI, I mean, that's what you're doing. What are you noticing, and Carl talks about the... I mean, I don't want you to talk out of school about the company you're working for, but he talks about they're trying to lead all these people, I mean, all these people, everybody, you, me, everybody, into this, I'll use the term subscription model. Or even like the attorneys here in the office, I mean, they're using AI a lot, I mean, Greg does. But he's got something where for the first 6 months or something, it's, I don't know if it's free, but it's damn near free. And afterward, you know, it's going to go way up. And your company obviously does a lot using AI. Do they have a overriding subscription with one AI provider? Or how do they pay them? Do you have any idea?
So, I mean, honestly, not a great one, because it's, in my experience, it's kind of like, at my level, because, you know, I'm more of like an entry-level kind of, you know, SEO marketer is my title. It's essentially like, when you want to use AI, like, it's just like, oh, you know, choose the AI of your choosing. You know, whatever program works best for you. In my case, I mainly use Gemini. And it's never once, like, asked me for, you know, like a login. Well, I'm logged into Google, but it's never asked me for, like, a subscription to pay for anything. It's never told me, oh, you've generated too much, you know.
But is this yours or just the company's?
I believe, so I'm going to be honest, they never really exactly explained it. I believe I'm signed in with my company email, but I don't think that has an effect on it. Like, I haven't seen anything on there saying, like, you know, you have a premium subscription through your company. As far as I know, it's just Gemini itself. Because, I mean, just a few months ago...
You can get something. You can go online. You can get the... But I think, you know, Carl's talking about, and Kevin says at the university, they're paying, and at some point, you end up having to pay per token. I mean, if you have to pay per search at some level, or you pay for a certain number of searches, and when you go over there, you got to pay a lot more. And Carl was talking about how the expectation from everybody investing, you know, billions and billions of dollars in stuff is in 3, 4, and 5 years, or maybe even sooner, everybody's going to be paying a bunch into this. I mean, you're not going to replace your people for nothing. I mean, I was just wondering if you went to one of the other stuff, like the new Chinese place and stuff, is it almost as good? I mean, Carl said it's not as good, but it's, you know, half as good might be good enough for everybody. I mean, so you just use the one that you, how did you decide that was the best one for you?
So in my case, we're generating content for websites, so articles and such. And we have this like dashboard that we use. That's how, because like I mentioned before, I work from home, and it has an integrated AI, and it just kind of doesn't, it's very repetitive. You'll be like, you know, like, hey, give me article titles, you know, give me inspiration to, at least, quick side note, I am pretty, you know, anti-AI. Like, as soon as I clock out, I am not touching that thing at all. So I try to be as, I guess you could say, original as I can with the content, but, I mean, so much of it is literally just, you know, type me an article, boom, done, and then, you know, there it goes. With that aside, so, like, I'll put in there, like, you know, like, give me article titles or whatever, and the one we have that's, like, integrated into the dashboard, it's kind of like that's what I was getting at. It gives repetitive answers. It will kind of like, if you say like, hey, write me an article on lawn irrigation, and then write me an article on something completely different, like epoxy flooring for garages. Obviously very different topics, but you'll kind of get like a very similar flow. You'll get like a here's how it works paragraph, here's why it works, here's like the environmental, it always loves putting in like environmental positives at the end of the article. And it basically, again, yeah, it was making very, very similar stuff. So I then moved to ChatGPT, and I was getting a lot of like, not necessarily what they call hallucinations, but just kind of weird, like, kind of signs that this wasn't written by a person, where just like, you know, like weird grammatical stuff, and formatting was really weird. And then finally, I was recommended to switch over to Gemini, and yeah, that's kind of just the most, like, the reason why I use it is because it's the most...
Who's Gemini? Who's behind that?
Google.
Okay.
It's just the most efficient for creating what I need to create. And just going back a little bit to the question of, like, the company's paying for it, so I absolutely know that the wider company is, like, they do purchase tokens, and they do pay for the usage.
Never call you and say you're using too many or anything like that.
No, yeah, that's like, because like I said, this is my first experience using a bunch of AI and everything. I've been learning a ton. Like, I've been going into this like writing, copywriting and stuff like that. That's where I got the experience using AI. That's where I'm kind of all new. Because it's Google, my account is linked with my work account. But again, I've never seen anything on there necessarily saying like you have unlimited generations. Never seen anything on there.
Maybe they've paid up to a certain level and they're not there yet.
Yeah. So that could be the possibility of going back earlier, like what my company's paying for. I absolutely know the wider company is, you know, because we have like engineers and developers and people who kind of, some people work on optimizing, like, getting the most out of the AI. Some people work on, like I mentioned, our own dashboard and getting the most out of that. So I'm sure they're using it a lot more in depth than I am.
What are you aware? Kevin always says that if you like, for instance, and we would never do this, but if my brother wanted to use AI for all the books and records at PTI, and you put them on there to help you out, that becomes their stuff. So if somebody else says,
yeah,
you know, design me a boutique brokerage firm, they might be using our balance sheet, right? I mean, do your guys warn you not to put any of your stuff on there?
In my case, there's nothing. We essentially don't really put any of our information on there.
Is that on purpose?
It's just in my case, it just wouldn't be necessary.
Okay.
Because again, it's like I'll go in there to, like, again, main thing is like generating articles. So I will put in, let's say, like, I mean, a perfect example is like, writing a blog post for, again, I'll say lawn, landscaping company. I'll be given a topic, and basically that's what I'm given. I'm given, the company and a keyword, which will be used to help the SEO ranking, which AKA just means help people find it online. What I will do is I will then, again, this is where I try to be a little bit more creative, you know, not just everything AI. I will think of article titles that could be helpful, like, you know, okay, like it'll be like, what to do with your first time hiring a landscaping company, or,
So this is for some landscaping company, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Sorry, I keep
saying. So how do you hire a boutique money management firm, and we write the article? Oh, by the way, you better check these guys out at PTI, something like that. Is that the conclusion?
So sorry, I gave it a pretty long-winded explanation. Yeah. I wasn't getting to the point.
But I mean, you have, like, a client, and the idea is to drive people to the client.
Yes. Yeah. So from the top down, it's like the major, or what we do is companies buy packages. And it can be, there's different levels. Base level is like, we will update your website and we will write some blog posts for you. And we're not like designers where, you know, we're not gonna like make your website look beautiful, make it look amazing. I mean, obviously we'll try our best, but what we do is optimize it for SEO. So keywords, like I mentioned earlier, is the main thing.
So if you went to a PTI website, ours needs a redo, you would make it so it shows up way more in searches and stuff.
Yes, yeah. So like the core of it.
How effective is that?
It really makes a difference.
Wow.
Because every single website has what's called a meta description and a title tag, and what you put into those really does change how things come up in a search result. I believe by default most websites just don't even have any, like, or at least it's a,
well, the ones that are done a year, years, how,
yeah,
I'm gonna ask you a real stupid question. We'll lead anyway. SP Futures down 5, NASDAQ Futures down 95. Come back here a little bit. There's a restaurant right around the corner from me. It has been there forever, you know, and I've known the guy since he was at another restaurant, but they retired like a year ago. And it was always successful, blah, 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 comfortable, nice place. Neighborhood people love it. Well, now this new group rents the place. I think he still owns a building. I won't say the name of it, but they pour in, and the place is, like, mobbed. Food's not as good. It's more expensive. And plus, you can't really get in there, right? So in order to be Yogi and say, you know, nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded. But basically, it's too crowded. And I think these guys yelped the crap out of themselves, like, on day one. I think they started yelping the place before they served their first hunk of chow. And the place, the none of the people, I won't say none, but a lot of people are not from the neighborhood. It's somehow or another, somebody, it's a pretty good-sized chain, but, you know, not of, like, a McDonald's, but of restaurants. And they are packed every night. And it's nowhere near as good, and it's more expensive than the person who was there. I mean, is this stuff that powerful? And all the people there are, they're not your age, but they're in their late 20s, 30s, and they all seem to be coming from, like, different parts of the city in the burbs. They must just, somehow or another, these guys must pop up on every search there is.
So, Ed, it's funny, that's different. So, reviews are like its own field in itself, essentially. Making sure you have positive reviews on popular sites like Yelp and everything are like, again, that's like a business in itself. In my case, the
how do you do that? You just write them? You write the reviews?
That, honestly, a whole nother business. So, like, well, essentially, the way it should be is, you know, you earn good reviews naturally, but obviously, you know, people game the system.
That's way too boring.
Yeah, like, I think it is. I wouldn't say there's, I mean, again, this is something I know very little about, because this is very different from SEO. My guess on it would be that it's not necessarily companies, you know, it's not like hey, we're Fake Reviews LLC, and, you know, we'll write reviews for you. Maybe that is the case, but there's probably just some people out there, you know, where it's like, you know, hey, you give me some cash or something, and then in return I can... Well, there's probably two sides of it, where there probably is, influencers who will literally go there and then, you know, give positive reviews and in return for free food. Or there are probably, you know, like, script and bot writers who will just make up, you know, fake reviews and everything.
Well, it's kind of it's interesting, because in my business, in the, brokerage business or money management business, the advertising is very restricted. What you're basically talking about, what a review is, it's sort of a half-assed testimonial.
Yeah.
I mean,
in
our business, the brokerage business, testimonials are flat-ass prohibited. I mean, I could no more have a commercial where some guy comes on and goes, gee, I gave this chief guy my dough, and man, I'm rolling in dough. You absolutely can't do it. There's no way you can even word them. The testimonials are banned. I mean, you don't see our website or any kind of piece of paper that we'd hand out like at a seminar with 15 idiots in the bottom of it going, oh, get these guys, you'll never be broken, you know, that kind of thing. You could never do that. Yet every other industry, that seems to be the way they do business, right? At some level. I mean, somebody's either giving a recommendation or somebody's doing something, right? I mean, and obviously Yelp is sort of a thing like that. It's basically a website for testimonials, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's something that, I mean, it's funny, yeah, like in this business or in your business, you know, yeah, testimonials are, nothing. It's like...
They're illegal. If you put one on there, boy, you're going to get written up.
Yeah, yeah, and meanwhile, everywhere else, it's like, testimonials are tossed around so carefree, I would say, that I don't... But I'm pretty skeptical with any of them, you know? Like,
yeah, well,
there are some people out there who will completely, you know, like, okay, where am I going to go to eat? And it is whatever those reviews are, they follow them. And I never follow reviews. I mean, unless it's like obvious, like one star, this place sucks. Like,
yeah.
I've places that are 3-star reviews, like I've never, you know, I don't know. I've never like gone there and been like, oh, this is terrible. Like I'm never coming here again. Like I don't know. I don't really trust that kind of stuff.
Well, keep your eye on the Zoom, because we should have John and Eric piling in here at some point.
Yeah. Good morning.
Hey,
Adam,
hey, what's up?
Hello.
Let's see. Well, Andrew, are you gonna dash? I'll talk to John for a bit.
All right. I'll grab us some coffee.
All right. John, how are you?
I'm good.
Something's up with Kevin.
Makes me think I don't want to use Yelp at all.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I'm sure there are some people on there that you know, but the term I got Yelped, I mean, all of a sudden you'll see a place, you know, that had, like, nobody there, and the next night it's mobbed. What do you think the difference is? I mean, you know, in some degree. It's, you know, it's all a game. But I can't believe how effective it is, you know, in some
of
these
areas. Effective, too, as a means of destroying a vendor, too. You know, if there's a grudge of some kind, and, there's an effort to, you know, bombard somebody, fake negative reviews to affect their business or put them out of business. It works both ways. It works any way you want to manipulate it, really.
When Andrew comes back, he's got to send Eric the Zoom link. I'll just text him and say same one. So what, I mean, were you listening earlier about us talking about managing money today because I was on with Joel yesterday. Pretty interesting, huh?
Yeah. Well, about individual debt and the debt owed to particular places.
Well, without getting into a political sort of thing, but it is, no matter what you do, you're into the politics. I mean, right now, you know, we had Besent do his two little thingies of 2 weeks ago, and one of them is the yen part isn't quite anywhere near where he did it before, but the 10-year interest rate is appreciably higher than when he did it before. Does that mean somewhere today, tomorrow, or the next day, I should be trading ahead of what somebody else is going to know before me, or even though he threatened to do it again, he's not going to do it again? I mean, this is kind of crazy. You sit here all day long waiting for somebody to do something out of the blue that other people are going to find out before you. Even if I'm going to say that when government does something, somebody probably always finds out about it before regular people, but I think these guys have taken it to the next level, but other people did it too. I mean, Goldman Sachs, those people always found out before we did. You know, John, I think it sucks. I think government should stay the hell out of this. And if they stayed out of it, markets would run a lot better, I think. But they don't. I mean, it's, I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting old and grumpy about it.
This is above my pay grade to kind of unthread all this stuff. But I really believe that there's something that's, you know, it's got vast coordination behind it. And it's, you know, it's pitted factions like the EU against us. Canada is clearly aligning itself with the EU. And you've got, you know, the EU, the individual countries that are in political turmoil or ferment, where you've got, you know, their governments under assault by right-wing candidates to kind of reverse the energy that we've seen develop there for the last 20 or 30 years. You've got the deal with, you know, Venezuelan oil. You've got...
What kind of deal do you think? How do you sign a 100-year deal with people that aren't even in charge? I mean, this is bizarre world, John.
Well, Rodriguez, I mean, she hailed it. She's about the only figurehead I can point to down there. So, I don't know how much control she really has, but I think it's all of this to me has become a way of posturing whatever, you know, position, whatever side of the political fence we're on here, and it's about big game stakes. I mean, really big game stakes. The Canada trade, you know, collapse is, I think, purely politically driven. So I mean that's and how do you kind of scan the politics to figure out what the objective is? Is there a long range objective? Was just a short term solution to something, or a shot across the bow somehow? None of this is clear enough for me to say here's what it is, and I know this for a fact. Well, I can't do that, but I get the sense that there is there's a desperation to what's happening, and it's, you know, kind of like a last fight, like, you know, OK Corral or something.
Well, I think, honestly, John, I mean, I don't, whatever people think the politics is, I look at this national debt number, I think the desperation is on our end. I mean, most of the Canadian debt, they have Canadian debt, most of it's owned by Canadians. Where ours, a lot of it isn't. And, we are in deep doo-doo. I mean, we can't wait to screw around. I mean, yesterday, I couldn't believe when I heard the stuff about, you know, I could care less about the Falkland Islands. But evidently, our position forever is we've been neutral over whether it's been the Brits or the Argentinians. I mean, why do we want to get into that fight? All of a sudden, yesterday, Trump gets in the fight. For what? Just to drive attention from something else? I mean, I just looked a minute ago. We owe Britain $970 billion. Isn't that somewhat important when you go to piss somebody off? I mean, what are we doing here? I mean, I don't
think it's about even worrying. You know, this may sound ridiculous. I don't think it's about, you know, worrying about the balance sheet between these countries. But I look at what's happening between Russia and the UK, and the US, you know, defying the UK about the Falkland Islands, which, you know, has, I think, real significance to the Brits. It's got real significance to geopolitics when somebody turns on a dime like that and starts, you know, speaking a different language. But it's, this is, you know, the, I think the UK is very much at the center of a lot of this, and it's a nation in what I would call complete collapse.
So, I mean, well, but you're listening to, they don't have anywhere near the debt problems we do.
I'm sorry?
They don't have anywhere near the debt problems we do. Why,
well,
are they collapsing, not us?
About debt. I'm leaving debt off the table for the moment. I mean, they're in a state of cultural collapse, moral collapse, religious collapse.
Maybe they look healthy on
some balance sheet, Tom, but I think the country.
I don't
just
know that they would necessarily agree with that, but.
Maybe, a lot of the people would.
But a lot of people here do think the same way. I mean, it's all who you talk to, right? I wonder if when somebody has to have a new thing to talk about every day, they just keep the pump primed. You wonder what they don't want you to hear. I mean, why is that even news? What is the point of that? I mean, every day there's like something. I mean, what are we trying to hide? I don't. Is there something we're trying to hide? I don't get it. But I mean, someplace somewhere, these numbers. You know, I admit that I drive for the numbers, but the numbers drive people. We're talking to, you know, Andrew a bit about, you know, going to school, going to Columbia. And Eric will be on in a minute if he's not already here. At some point, if you pile out of, I'll use the term Columbia, and you're 200 grand in debt, Andrew, make sure Eric's got the right spot. It's a life changer. And anybody who doesn't think that the debt we got ourselves up to our ass in, if anybody doesn't think that that's a life changer for the Americans of the next 20 or 30 years, is just wrong. I mean, maybe it doesn't seem like it's going to be yet. Maybe you know, sorry about this. Maybe the, you know, the right wing neocons or whoever the hell's around or to don't think that somehow or another this is going to affect them. Yeah, it is, because, you know, and I'm not, John, I think you would never accuse me of being a tax and spend guy at all. But I mean, I'm looking at this, and anybody who thinks they got a lot of dough and all of a sudden someplace somewhere, be it the Republicans or the Democrats, is going to come after some of that money because we're friggin' broke, you're looking through rose-colored glasses. Where else are we going to get the dough? I mean, we're looking like we're trying to steal some from Venezuela. Okay, well, that's one way of doing it. Or we're going to do a whole bunch of tariffs, which is just another tax, but people are too dumb to realize that, or some people are. I mean, it becomes, you can say, I can come out of school with, by the way, who are the schools, did you listen yesterday, who are the schools now that are over 100 grand for a year? I didn't see the list, but there's some schools that have popped through the...
I can guarantee you those are schools that are not worth it, too.
Well, but I'm saying, all right, so somebody piles out of there with 300 grand. If you don't think, unless you immediately become a VP in daddy's big company where you're making 400 grand a year, if you don't think that's a life-changing event, I mean, this generation, and you and I got some time left, this is a life-changing event for us. If we don't think, be it, you know, this guy pushing through tariffs or somebody else doing something else, if you don't think this number has to be addressed at some point here, I don't see how people can feel that way. Do you? I mean, it's too big. It's not, you know, if somebody owed, you know, 3 grand when we came out of school, it's not a life-changing event. If somebody would have come out of, when we graduated, if somebody come out of school with 100 grand in debt, for God's sake, they got to still be working it off, don't they?
Yeah, well, at the time, somewhere along the line, the crazy formula became kind of ironclad, that the most expensive school, the most exclusive school, carried the greatest cachet when it came to finding some kind of spot in life later on, and you would put yourself into horrendous debt, banking on the fact that this is my lifeline. If I don't go to college, you know, ABC, I'm screwed for the rest of my life. And I mean, that was a horrible overselling of first what any college degree is capable of giving somebody. And really, the college degree doesn't give anybody anything. It's what you take from it. that is, you know, and you have to sweat all right, well, and fight to
all right,
get it. So
all right, back up a hair on that, because here's where I have my guest being you, and I agree with you 100%, but now I'm going to disagree. Not in terms of, let me put it to you this way. You're a lawyer, still are, was. Plus, you're never not a lawyer, right? It's like, you know, once you're an armed robber, you're always an armed robber. Oh, wait a minute, wait a minute, I didn't say that. there is a somewhat of a cachet in where you went to school. And I've always been charitable in saying that the reason why people want people from certain schools is they're too lazy, unable to essentially do the selection process themselves. So they go to the school that they think has the best selection process, where anybody coming out of there has to be a type A guy, you know. But, I mean, when you say there's not much difference in the intellect or the training in a guy who went to Harvard versus law school versus John Marshall, I think on some level you're correct. But in terms of what...
Well, I would say there's a huge difference, though.
Okay, well, that's what I'm trying to get you to explain.
People actually flunked out of John Marshall. I don't know if... Does anybody ever flunk out of Harvard?
Well, what I'm saying is there is a difference in the sense that if you and I were with, you know, Schmo and Schmo, some big firm, we feel very comfortable if you and I are the two lead guys bringing in three idiots from Harvard in their first week, sitting them down next to me and charging a guy $800 an hour. I'd say, who are these guys? Well, they're from Harvard. Oh, okay. Well, I don't think we would have the balls to do that if the three guys from John Marshall, even though they might be smarter than the guys from Harvard. I'm saying there is part of what you're talking against, and I agree with you, has to do with people's perception of the person, because, by the way, if they got into Notre Dame, they must have been smart. Nobody dumb gets in there anymore. Maybe they were when we went in there. Same thing. How does somebody get into Harvard and be an idiot? You know. So if I hire,
that's because Harvard lets in idiots.
Well, okay.
Yeah. this is what's been hidden, I think, and why people have over invested in these.
Eric, Eric's with us. We're having a discussion about, you know, why some schools get away with charging a lot more, and I say because people, the selection process is that people feel that if they hire that person, they're hiring somebody better. And it's that mentality that causes a lot of this, don't you think? Or we're not?
Well, you know, certain colleges have a reputation for being, you know, the only people who get into this college are smart people. That's the that's the perception. That's the reputation. And that's one of the things that they're selling. You know, we're Harvard University. The only people who can get into Harvard are really smart people. Therefore, even someone who finishes at the bottom of their class at Harvard is probably way smarter than the person who went to, college, State U somewhere. But I think also you got to, you know, differentiate between grad school and undergraduate. Because, you know, the graduate school, law school, and other things are really specialized areas. And that is a different kind of education. And they're looking at very specific things in what a particular grad program can teach people and who's doing the teaching. And so they're not necessarily the same thing. But a lot of these, as Chaim was just referring to, is a lot of these so-called high-prestige schools allow in the sons and daughters of alumni. For instance, George W. Bush got in Yale. I don't necessarily know if he got in because he was a genius, and maybe more so because his father was an alum, and I also think his grandfather was an alum.
You think he was flounder, like in the movie? He was a legacy?
Well, no, I mean, big colleges, big college, if you want to call it that. Like they call some law firms big law. Okay, big college. I mean, some colleges will allow in the descendants of previous students.
How many do you think still do that? I think in Notre Dame it kind of stopped.
I don't know how many, but I know some do and have. And that, of course, these students come in and, you know, nobody ever, of course, questions why they're there. You know, they'll question the black student, for instance, well, you got in because of affirmative action or something, but they never, ever question a white student who shows up at Yale or Harvard or someplace because, basically, because they're, you know, the colleges, well, there are colleges that will set aside seats for the descendants of past.
Was it always every graduate or just certain graduates?
I would imagine it would differ for different colleges, but I know that that's happened. But I think the thing always to understand is that, like I said, grad school, like something like law school, there's a real big difference between that and undergrad, and there is definitely a tier of what are considered upper tier law schools, where you're going to get a much more intense and challenging education in the law than you would necessarily get it at a place like John Marshall, which is no knock against John Marshall, but it's just that this is one of the things. Of course, you know, and of course, the thing with law is of course, nobody learns how to be a lawyer in law school. You learn how to be a lawyer when you get hired. But there is this idea that you can handle, you know, how well can you write a memo, for instance? How well can you write a brief? And that some places you're going to get a better training in those kinds of things than you're necessarily going to get at, at a smaller law school.
You know, one of our mutual friends, and Jan has met him as well, his daughter went to Fordham, and he says that because it's so small, it's one of the hardest ones to get into, and they have a huge cachet. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That all those kids are, not all, but a lot of them are, you know, working for some congressional guy during the summer, or even an appellate or a Supreme Court judge and stuff. That just because of location or you know, good kids, or both?
Well, again, I think some places, you know, the insights, the skinny is, this is a tough, you're going to get really good training at this law school. And, I mean, my wife she went to the University of Chicago as an undergrad and got her law degree from Berkeley.
Wow. How the hell did she get out to Berkeley?
That's a trip. Well, her father had moved to California.
Ah.
And she was out there, and she had gotten accepted to Berkeley, and I think she had also been accepted to Stanford, but Stanford was a lot more money. And Berkeley was a top-tier school, and it didn't cost as much money. And so she went on ahead and chose to go to Berkeley and was very happy. She was very happy with her education.
How do you become... Aren't you kind of, I guess, you know, California's a big state, but aren't you sort of out of the intern loop from, like you would be closer to Washington, or do they still participate somehow in that?
No, because the way that they do the hiring, and I know this because I wrote a feature story about it when I was a reporter, is that the law firms will send around representatives to the law schools, the big law schools. And then they will hold these interviews, and in Washington D.C., the ones that they were holding them back in the 90s at a hotel near Union Station, and you'd walk into the lobby, and there were all these law students dressed dressed professionally, who had interviews, and they were interviewing to be a summer intern. Because a lot of law firms will hire, if you come in as a summer intern and do well, they will offer you a job. Now, this was back in the days when, you know, lawyers were getting hired all over the place. This is before the two economic downturns where a lot of lawyers were let go.
How does Tina find a way to get from Berkeley to Washington and get an apartment and all that stuff to work there for the summer? Who the hell pays for all that?
Well, it depends on, you know, what firm you're with. The firms, the ones that had a lot of money, they would spend a lot of money trying to woo what they thought were the best law students to come in and be an intern. Oh, they would wine you and dine you and, you know, make you think that, oh boy, it's going to be great working for us. And then the reality would come in later about exactly what the job was going to be. But no, they would interview the law students, and the idea was, you know, if you could get a summer internship, and usually there would be two, like 3 years in law school, so you have two summer internships, and that if you did well and they liked you, that they would then offer you a job. I don't know if they exactly how every law firm handled if they gave the students a stipend to pay for their rent for the summer. It was usually like, you know, June and July or something.
Yeah, the summers are pretty small now for students.
Yeah. And so, and of course, and they were sending, and of course, these law firms are sending these crews, beating the bushes, as it were. They're sending them all over the country. Although I imagine some would have particular colleges that they always tried to hit. Now, when the story I did, you know, there were students there from Georgetown University, American University, George Washington University, a number of, I think one from, some from Catholic University. And they would just all come in and get interviewed.
Jan, which one of these places recruited you?
Are you kidding? I was at DePaul. We were training Chicago lawyers. I mean, they really didn't have. I mean, there were students from out of state at DePaul, but it was the reputation of the graduates and so on was based on how they performed in the Chicago market. They were not necessarily coming to DePaul to go on to greener pastures, in government or the federal judiciary or anything like that. They were here to practice law and to either start a business or take over a business from a parent or something, and it was about learning the ropes of being a lawyer in the Cook County system. So it was, I think all the law schools now have styled themselves that isn't a workable model anymore. They have to position themselves as attracting an even broader student base, and to promise or to imply that you will be, prepared for jobs far beyond what you would have ever put your sights on being a DePaul graduate, say, in the 40s or 50s. And they're all, Notre Dame is an example of this too, where it's got an international profile it never had when we were there. But it is a magnet for people from all over the world, and it styled itself as somebody who's sending these people back out into the world in the biggest possible sense to do world-shattering things. And I guess maybe every parent thinks their kid should have such an option and find a spot that will give them the biggest possible footprint later on in the job market or in their earning power. But it's boomerang, and I don't think there's enough of those jobs to go around, for one thing, and we've lured people into thinking that if you just go to a school that's got the right name and got the right endowment and everything else, the rest of your life is taken care of. And I don't think that was ever the case, and it's less the case now than ever before.
Well, how much of it is education? One of the couple of guys, they're in the office here, they're attorneys, rent space on our floor. They say places like Notre Dame have done an amazing job in the sense that if you like the place, if all of a sudden you have a case in Iowa, you pick up the Notre Dame alumni law thing, and there's a guy in Iowa, and you call him, and there's your guy. How much of it is that? The connections between?
That was always a part of the the reward system, that you had alumni who would give a break to a Notre Dame grad before they might give it to somebody they never heard of, or from a school they never heard of. So it could work to your advantage. I think it helped me in the job market several times just because of the name recognition Notre Dame had. And I think that's what a lot of families today are hoping, that a son or daughter can find the school that's got the right, you know, matchup to open doors for them later on. Not thinking about the education at all, but about what reputation and word of mouth is going to do for them. And that's the kind of the sad state of the job market right now. It's you're hoping for those kinds of solutions to problems that go pretty deep, because it, you know, at that level, you're not really worried about your individual skills or how much you've got to offer to an employer. It's how many doors are going to open to you because of the name on the letterhead of your transcripts. You know, it's just,
well, you guys don't. I'm always, you know, I get to listen to everybody on the show, so we have to go to break here. No, we don't, not for a while. But interesting. I don't know what Andrew's trying to say here, but the interesting part is when you throw this inflation, which we've had and continue to have, and into the whole mix. Eric, before you came on, I was mentioning to John that when you're in debt, it changes your whole life. And if there's any kind of inflation that all of a sudden you can't deal with, it changes your whole life. I mean, you may not think it does, but it does, and it maybe gets there by, you know, Chinese water torture, one drop a second, but it'll get there. And when your law school, what you guys have just described, maybe even without knowing it, is that now it's not necessarily learning the law, which of course you have to do. It's positioning yourself to get in the firm that can pay you enough, that has clients that can pay them enough to pay off your loan. And by the way, if you ever need a car or a house someday, and that's a whole different program than maybe 80 years ago, just learning the law and coming out and saying, I'm a lawyer. You know, you didn't pay that much to do it. And, you know, before you came on, Eric, we're talking about the government now, our U.S. government, is in the same pickle. Is now all of a sudden, you know, they're broke. And when I say broke, they're in debt more than anybody ever dreamed they would be, except for after a war. But after a war, you're usually in debt to your own people, or now we're in debt to our own people and a bunch of other people. So now what's going to happen going forward? I mean, we're talking about the legal group, but I mean, we're talking about people that are spending, you know, 100 grand a year in law school and other stuff. Now, they expect to get paid X in order to pay that off. Well, that may be a pipe dream, but it's a number. All right, now, you and I and John, if we have a legal case, he may think he's worth $1,000 an hour, but guess what? We can't pay it. So, there's a whole divergence. I mean, if you go into the, I mean, you guys have been into the Club Lago. I go there once in a while. It's got a great bar because it's on a block where it's not downtown real estate. You know, it's still not cheap, but the guys you want to have a conversation with are attorneys that are doing what I would consider to be, John, this regular law. They're representing policemen, they're representing this person, they're representing that person. I mean, or you can go in, you know, one of the bars down here, or in the, you know, the Prime Cut or someplace, and you're going to find some lawyers from that building. What are they, John? Is it Kirtland Ellis? Who's in that building? Somebody's in that building. Now, those guys, that's a whole different world. They're dealing with, you know, companies that are paying $800 an hour or more. Where the guys we're talking to at Lago, they're lucky if the guy pays, right? I mean,
it affects the client base that these firms draw from just as much as the students that, you know, they hire as interns and everything else.
I mean,
but you know, one of the things also is, you know, for a lot of lawyers, you know, sometimes their first job, and the only reason I know this is that I'm working on a novel where one of the characters is a lawyer, and I wound up researching and finding out a lot more about lawyers than I ever knew before I started. But you know, sometimes, you know,
what kind of lawyer? Bill Murphy lawyer or
even lawyers working at a big law firm, some of them will get entry level. The first job they'll have doing just basically going over contracts, doing due diligence. And some of these contracts or mergers of companies are huge, and they're just pages upon pages of documents. Now, in the old days, what would happen is the new bunch of lawyers would have to usually go to a place off-site from the law firm where the records of the two companies where the due diligence was going to be done on, and they'd walk into a room and it would just be stacks of boxes along a wall, and then they had to sit there and go through each one. Now, then somewhere about 15 years ago, that got shifted over, or maybe more than 15 years ago, it got shifted over to being on a digital. And now they can sit in front of a computer, you know, no more going off site to going through boxes and stuff. Now I can sit and look at this stuff on a computer. One of the things that AI may wind up doing is eliminating the need for that. Because a lot of this is just going over these documents and making sure that all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted, and so that there's the due diligence process, there isn't some ticking bomb in there like a company that's looking to be bought, and then it turns out that their major client. That they sell stuff to, that contract is about to go up. It's about to end in about a year, which might make that company a lot less valuable in a year's time if they don't keep their supplier going. So, but now you got AI that might be able to do that, and then you would not need a whole bunch of junior associates sitting there looking at this stuff. Another thing is, of course, there has been pushback from some big law firm clients about all of the amount of money they're paying per hour, because this is all being billed by the hour, and there's some clients have said, wait, well, we're paying all this money to basically have, you know, because you have a bunch of folks who are in their first or second year out of law school basically just going over this stuff. And yet we're getting billed a lot of money for this. And so, you know, and nobody knows how this is going to necessarily, like in a lot of fields, how this is necessarily going to shake out. But theoretically, we could come to a point where they don't need a whole bunch of new lawyers to do due diligence.
Well, I hope AI does better in spell check. I hope it does better in spell check.
But look, here's one of the things we know about technology. Eventually, it gets better.
Yep.
It gets cheaper, and it gets better. And one of the reasons so many folks are throwing so many, billions of dollars worldwide now into AI is, even though AI is really not paying, compared to the amount of money that's being thrown in at it, is that the idea is that in the long term, once all of the problems get shaken out of it, it's going to be something that is going to allow you to do a lot of work a lot faster, and you won't need nearly as many people. My youngest brother is a copy editor at the Tribune. Now, he already does the job by himself that when I first walked into the newsroom of the Chicago Tribune in, 1974, took, 12 people to do. He can now do that. He can now lay out stuff not only for the Tribune, but for some of the smaller papers that the Tribune also owns and operates. But he was talking to a friend of his who works for a newspaper in Colorado. This is just recently. And his friend said they started using AI in the copy editing process, and they got an AI thing that can lay out the stories. It can give you three possible headlines to use. What AI can't do yet is do captions for photographs or art. Wow. But eventually, you know, it's going to get around to being able to do that. And my brother asked this guy, he says, well, how many people do you have there at that paper doing that? And he said, well, we had 10. He said, my brother Mitchell said, well, how many people do you actually need? And he said, two. So this is one of the things in terms of not just the legal profession, but a lot of professions where you needed people to be there to really do a lot of diligent spot work.
My uncle was a tool and die maker during the war and stuff. Well, he ended up getting a job where he became a installer and repairer of printing presses for newspapers and all the other stuff. But he piled in, and you know this, I don't know if John does, the difference in the offset and what was the other printing. Used to actually, when you did a newspaper page, people would have to put the letters. I mean, when the thing runs over this thing, it's this stone or metal type printer. I mean, that's how it comes over so fast. But they used to actually put the letters in, you know, by hand. That was die set or whatever the hell they called it. Well, then the new thing was called offset, where you actually could have computers. You could type in what the article was, and the stuff would place the thing on the whatever you want to call it, the die that the thing came off. It was a big deal. So he got real popular because he was one of the first guys that knew how that used. But there's been innovation in this newspaper stuff. I mean, pretty much, you know, all along the way. I guess the question I wanted to ask is how much all this stuff, you know, is going to cost, and is it going to be cheaper for somebody to be, you know, to get legal? In other words, if everybody starts using AI and we get rid of people, I mean, my training in economics would be that somewhere along the line here, a lawyer is going to be cheaper. I don't see that sort of happening. But by the way, you mentioned, John, you mentioned, we got a couple of minutes before a break. You remember, Eric, you used to come to a couple of those Tooman nights. You remember that guy, Peter? He's the Marquette Park guy.
Yes.
Peter got his start in he was in bum court for a while. He was as a clerk. Then they had a whore court. They had all these different courts at night where they'd kind of, you know, arrest people and bring them in there. And he would tell some stories. One night he goes, some big firm decided that they were going to donate time to, you know, like regular lawyers, right? So the dude, I think he comes down to bum court and he starts picking off, representing some of these people that didn't have any attorneys, right? Well, there's a couple of guys there that was their livelihood. So the guy picks up one of these guys, and evidently, when you knew you weren't going to get paid, one of the ways you got money is if somebody got bond, you got it, which of course there is no such thing, I guess, now as bond, but in those days, if you introduced a guy to the bail bondsman, the lawyer got a little cut from the bail bondsman. So that was how you got paid, because the guys never paid you. The bums weren't going to pay you, right? So all of a sudden, this guy comes down, and he gets a bum, for lack of a better term, and he gets the guy, whatever, and he's let off on the bond. Well, the regular guy says, well, I want my piece of the bond. That should have been my guy. Well, they ended up getting this huge fist fight out in the hallway over the cut from the bail. So Peter says, he's the clerk, and the judge tells him, go out and break that up. He had to go out and break the fight up between the high-end attorney and the regular guy, because the high-end attorney wouldn't come across with the 50 bucks, because that's how the guy made his living, was getting the 50 bucks from the bond guy.
Yeah.
So is that what you learned? Go ahead. Is that what you learned at DePaul, John?
Well, it was that culture, and those are the best teachers, Tom. The ones who had done that, the ones who were still doing it. You know, I learned more from them than I did from the Ivy League place people around, where they were putting on the faculty in greater numbers. Mm. You know, same thing at Loyola when I went to grad school. It was the old Loyola grads who got hired by Loyola, who, you know, could teach the pants off of anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
They understood their students. They knew, you know, pretty much how they had come through the ranks in this place and in this country and in this state and everything. It was all very, you know, familiar to them, and they couldn't help teaching the ropes to that. And you know, as the faculty became more and more diverse or international, you lost a lot, believe me.
Well, he was telling me, you know, in this world where we have, you know, we're talking about girls playing with boys, playing with girls and all that stuff. Peter said one night he was in, they called it whore court, right? And they got all the lady prostitutes on one side and the guys on the other. Then there's the people in the middle that, whatever. So the judge goes, all right, book them all. And Peter goes, where do I book them? The judge goes, take the ladies with the ladies, take the guys, put them over in the guys' jail. And the guys in the middle, if they're snipped, they can go with the ladies. Otherwise, they got to go with the guys. I guess that was a solution.
Those are the good old days.
Good old days. But of course, you know, all of this depends on what kind of lawyer you are. I mean, you know, I don't know if this is necessarily going to, or how it's going to, I can't see how it would negatively affect a trial lawyer. If you have to go to court, you can't AI cannot go into court with you,
right?
And represent you if you're a divorce lawyer. We know our friend, for instance, our friend from our local friendly watering hole on Armitage, who was my own next door neighbor, Bill Murphy. You know, who is a trial lawyer, a defense attorney, another guy who retired now. Who hangs
by the way,
out
he had a trial yesterday and he won.
Yeah, yeah, a guy named Luke Coleman who hangs out there. Yep. He's retired now, but he was a trial attorney when he was working. If you need to get a divorce lawyer or something like that, I don't know if those kinds of lawyers are going to be necessarily negatively affected by AI, because you're still going to need a lawyer to go into court. Now, how it might affect lawyers who operate for, you know, certain transactions, like, you know, buying a piece of property, etc. I don't know how AI may make their jobs easier, but I don't know if it's necessarily going to eliminate them. I mean, you're still going to need somebody with who is past the bar to be there to look over certain kinds of transactions, and of course anything that happens in court. So I think how all of this shakes out is going to be exactly not necessarily what you do. For instance, newspapers are still going to need reporters.
Tell them that.
Well, you know, they're still going to need them. You know, I mean, somebody's got to write this stuff. And although the way to write it may become more stylized in the sense that, you know, a news story is, you know, as one of my early editors at the Washington Post once told me, he said, what we do here is more of a craft than an art. He says, what we do here is we lay bricks. And he was talking about writing news stories. And he says, you develop a style into which information can fit, and then you can lay a lot of bricks really fast. And once you learn that, basically news writing is just form writing. I think I said this last time, you know, it was really cold yesterday story, it really rained yesterday story, and these stories are essentially the same. You're just changing the information. And it may well be that a newspaper may say, you know, here are the three forms for it's something burned down yesterday. And you can, and it'll just have the blank spaces where you put in the different names or the addresses or, you know, other little details, and bingo, you have your story. And instead of taking you having to commit all of this to memory, which all of the veteran reporters I knew had on the Metro desk of the Washington Post had done, you'll just have it right there, and you can probably get a story done and over to the copy desk like really fast. And a story that might have taken you 45 minutes to an hour to write, you can have it ready to put in the to go to press or go to, you know, website screen whatever. Yeah. In a relatively short amount of time. That's something. I mean, there's going to be two ways that AI is going to affect things. It's going to affect things where it is going to eliminate jobs, but it is also going to eventually help people do their jobs a lot faster and still do a good job. It's not going to necessarily be a, but it, yeah, they're going to, things like, you know, spell check and other things, they're going to have to figure out the wrinkles. But, you know, given the way technology advances and progresses, I don't doubt that eventually a lot of those kinds of problems are going to be eliminated. Well, and then who knows what that's going to do?
Well, it's a speed, but you got to make sure you don't truncate your inquisitiveness because of the speed. We got to go quick break here, guys. SP Futures up 4, NASDAQ Futures down 39. Not much happening. It is a holiday week, and normally we wouldn't have much happen, but we're kind of waiting for stuff to happen this week with all the news around the world. But we'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats.
It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right
here, right now, right now. Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 4. We were down. NASDAQ futures down 37. We're down like 100 and something. So we've crept our way back here. Not sure if that's news around that we don't have or what it is, but it's better than just keep going down. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 86.3%, FTSE down 28.3%. CAC around down 2, call that flat. So a little moderately bearish over there, but nothing kind of big deal. Over in Asia, this is kind of surprising. Nikkei down 1,900, however, that's 2.8%. That's kind of a lot. The Hang Seng down 18, call that flat. Shanghai down 38.1%. So again, there's kind of a disconnect between mainland China and the Hang Seng just about every day here. I don't know why that is. Bonds, but here's we actually ducked. We're down 1/10 of a point here, 1 basis point. We're at 4.48. 4.79. We almost got to over 4.8 yesterday in the 10-year, which would be that's a number we're not supposed to see, but it looks like we're creeping that way. Oil down 54 cents to 89.68, so ducking under 90 bucks, and that part's good. RBOB up 2 cents, 315. So, again, you're planning to pay somewhere between, I'm going to say, 370 maybe in Indiana, where they've gotten rid of the state tax, to low fours here to low fives downtown, in case anybody's getting running by gas downtown. The gold down 13 bucks, 43.82. Silver down 30 cents, 65.06. Foreign exchange, this is one we got to watch here. We're watching the yen. It's just under the 160 number that everybody panics at over in Japan, 159.66. Euro dollar 115.7, kind of where it's been. British pound 135, say, right where it's been. Crypto down 461.76.799. So it raced up over 80. Now it's coming back down here, sort of like the gold did. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Cubs, not so good.
Yeah, not good there. It is 7:38 here in Chicago, September 2nd. And yeah, the Cubs lost. Let's see, sorry, these are my scores here for a second. Yep, Cubs lost to the Brewers 9-4. White Sox did win, though, over the Astros 5-1, but the Diamondbacks lost as well to the Phillies 7-1. Over Chicago weather, not looking much better at all today. It's going to be definitely a hot one. Currently 81 degrees. We're going to have a high of 93. We do have a heat advisory in place. Overall, the skies are going to be sunny, but we are going to have a little bit of a breeze in the afternoon, though. Things will only be heating up by the time that breeze comes in. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 86 degrees. They're going to have a high of 104. Partly cloudy skies and not a heat warning today, but doesn't seem much better out there. Over to Chicago traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, Tennessee at 32 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, Tennessee at 53. Eisenhower from Wolf Road, Tennessee at 52 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, Tennessee at 33 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from I-294 is Tennessee at 37 minutes. Back to you, Chief.
I think we have Kevin lurking on Zoom as well, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Kevin, how are you? Everything all right?
Yes, this morning, 369 on the Indiana Toll Road.
Yeah, you guys still aren't paying state tax, right?
Correct.
And that's got to be, what state tax?
Yeah, because it's way higher in Michigan. I didn't see a price in Michigan this morning. But, yeah, on my side of the state line, if I got gas there, it would cost a lot more.
I think Illinois state tax is like, what, 30 cents, 35, 40, something like that?
At least, yeah.
And federal is what? Still only like, well, only it's like 12 and a half, I think. Then there's, but yeah, and for the state tax, I thought when that guy did that, Kevin, that he was getting rid of the sales tax on gas, but he got rid of all of it.
I don't know if he got rid of the sales tax. I haven't paid attention to the particulars. I just look at the price, and then I go to Costco and save even more.
Well, I think gas is one of the only things, Eric, is our people can do whatever they want. I'm going to say gas is the only time you pay tax on tax. So the sales tax is on the entire amount, and not just on the, say, there's like a 90-some cent tax in Illinois. Without the sales tax, say 80-something. Well, the sales tax is also on the Illinois tax and the federal tax and the county tax, in addition to just the price of gasoline. How crazy is that?
I mean, that's the American way.
Yeah, I guess it's the American something. It's on some way. But we've been talking a lot lately, Eric, on the about the, you know, the college stuff. I mean, there's only so much we can talk about the deficit, other than whether the boom is going to land on our head or somebody else's, right? And how they're going to deal with that. Or I guess you could just, you know, go the Weimar Republic way and print them up enough money to where you're paying people back money way less than what they lent you. Let's hope we don't go down that road, but it looks like maybe we're partially doing that. Anyway, what do you make of all the college stuff? Kevin and I talked about it. I don't know if you saw last night, Kevin, or the SEC is absolutely evidently paying no attention to the court decision last Saturday, and they're piling up on LSU that nobody can use pros and blah 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 blah. I don't know.
Oh, they want to sanction and shun at LSU.
Yeah, yeah. I don't. Eric, can you think of any? I mean, you're minding your own business writing a book, but I know you listen to all this stuff. Can you think of any way colleges can accuse somebody else of being a pro? What do they think their guys are? Eric, you with us? Andrew, did you lose
it? I turned off my audio during the commercial.
Oh, all right. Well, so can you think of any? Can you think how laughable is it for a college team to call a pro and not their guys?
Well, I think it's what kind of pro you mean. The idea that somebody would, and one of the things they're worried about is that this is a slippery slope. That if you, because right now is you have some guys who graduated, went to a pro football camp and got cut, and not only did they not make the 53-man roster, they didn't make the seven. They didn't make the what they used to call the taxi squad. You know, those players that a team keeps right at hand in case the inevitable happens when somebody gets injured, and then they move a guy off of the ready squad.
It's practice squad, yeah.
Practice squad. And I think the slippery slope they're worried about is if you open the door to let someone who has signed an NFL contract, then you're going to start having guys who've played 2 or 3 years in the league saying, you know what, I can't stick with an NFL team, but I found College X that will pay me half $1 million because I have all this experience to come back and play for them. And I think that's I think it would not surprise me if that was one of the really big worries.
Eric, I think you're right about the slippery slope, but I think there's another piece to that as well, mm-hmm. and that is that they are still trying to cling to this idea that student athletes are engaging in an extracurricular activity. They're not employees of the university, and anything that sort of encroaches that that nonsensical position that they have on that is they don't want any part of it. I think they're trying to stave off making the players employees as long as they can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if it walks like a duck and
absolutely, like a duck. Absolutely. But legally speaking, there's a lot of things like workman's comp, labor law, all these things that start to apply that don't apply yet.
Yeah.
So, I understand why the colleges want to do it, but I think that's I think you're right on so many levels. The slippery slope is multidimensional.
I think they're at the bottom of the slope about now. But I find, as you know, Kevin, I aggravate the hell out of him because I do this. I look at this purely as an economic experiment. I mean, to me, it's like the deregulation of airlines. It's like the deregulation of trucking and railroads. Once you open up the economic world, a lot of people seem to think that they can control the economic world. Well, it's like saying, that guy down the block can't sell something less than me. How the hell is he doing that? That's unfair competition. What do you mean? He's not paying the boss as much as you're getting paid. I mean, the idea that you can somehow have a little bit of freedom of competition to where you can take a college school and make it a pro team, really, which is what they're doing. I mean, they are at this point, even though they don't know it yet. Lou says they do know it. They're becoming competitors of the NFL. I mean, if they're not already there. I mean, away. I mean, Kevin, aren't they all playing now on Friday nights? They stole that from the high schools, right? I mean, there's going to be. I think they're going to start playing on Sunday. I mean, wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean,
When's the? Well, actually, but it's not conflicting with the NFL because the NFL won't start for another week. But when are the Irish playing against Wisconsin this weekend, Sunday?
What do you mean? The NFL's tonight. Tomorrow, they're playing tonight is the first game.
Yeah, but they don't have a slate on the weekend.
Yeah,
they don't.
The NFL has been doing this for a long time, where they have their kickoff game come early, and it's usually in the middle of the week. It used to be on a Thursday, now I think it's going to be on a Wednesday.
Yeah, it's tonight. It's
And but you know, the thing is, teams have been paying players under the table for Lord knows how long, and this new system they have is basically acknowledging and legitimizing what had been going on at big colleges in particular for decades, in which players were paid under the table and they were given a certain amount of money, but they weren't getting any money. For instance, you know, everybody was in the bookstore on game day buying their jerseys, and they got no money from that at all.
By the way, it's next Wednesday. I'm sorry, me bad. Next Wednesday.
And they were getting no money from that at all. Or the team, you know, was getting a huge television contract in the millions to broadcast a game, and the players who were responsible for those millions coming in got no money whatsoever, ever. I mean, now, you know, teams are doing what, you know, for instance, SMU got a death sentence for. Well, you know, it was basically for, you know, paying, you know, we're going to pay the players. And so, and one could argue, you know, if you went to a college and you were a computer whiz, you know, the college had no problem, and nobody seemed to have a problem with the college hiring you to work there in the college in some computer lab or something. You know, any number of students, you know, can sometimes, because they have a particular skill, can sometimes get hired by the college that they're going to, and actually get paid, not just, you know, okay, we're going to reduce your tuition or something like that. So some of this is simply, it was and I think one of the reasons why the courts went on ahead and allowed it is that, you know, it is perfectly clear from all of the NCAA sanctions against this college and that college that the fact of the matter is that college, this is de facto going on anyway, and so let's just bring it out into the open and then put it on the open market. I mean, Indiana won the NCAA championship last year because of all the players they brought in who had not been at Indiana in 2024. It wasn't like suddenly they had a bunch of guys there who all matured into marvelousness for the 2025 season. Same thing with the University of Miami, where basically they took the quarterback who had been a starter at Georgia and made him their starter. And that's why they did as good as they did last year.
Eric, I'm going to push back a hair. And somewhere, Kevin and I have had a lot of our guys on our Notre Dame group kind of have the same initial feeling that you have. I don't know. I've always been a little bit when you look at when Kevin was it after we left school and Notre Dame got spanked for giving people some money under Holtz. A little bit of a spanking, but it was.
That was a booster, and she was determined to be a booster because she had a membership in a every Friday luncheon where they'd always get coaches to come and speak, and which they disbanded afterwards. And this woman happened. It was a very sordid incident.
I wasn't talking about that one.
Not only was she taking players on trips, she had personal relationships with them, and the money that she was using, she embezzled from her company. So it was a very sordid tale.
That's not the one I'm talking about. I'm talking about the one earlier than that where there were all these incidences of players getting money, and almost all of them were like, your second string end's uncle died, and one of the coaches gave him $100 for the Greyhound bus ticket home. It was that kind of stuff. And I at some level, I think those guys did a little better than some people. I mean, my cousin who played for Colorado, right? Well, he wasn't making very much because he ended up joining the ROTC, right? But he said there was a place downtown where you could go, and if you needed a pair of jeans, you didn't have to pay for them, you know, that kind of thing. So, Eric is right in the sense that it's been kind of there. But at some point now, when you're arranging a deal for my cousin to get $1 million from one place, and you're paying him 70, it's not the same thing. I mean, it's you know, at some point, I don't know what it's like saying, you know, getting your nephew a job, and you're going to work a polling place. Well, if the nephew shows up every day, it's not the same as getting $1 million from somebody in four jobs where they don't even show up. I guess at some point what I'm saying is the degree of it becomes a different crime, for lack of a better term. And I don't think, I mean, what did Dave Casper was in most of my classes in economics. The guy didn't have a car. I mean, you know, I didn't see him going out at night and having big steaks every night. Maybe he got something that I didn't get, but if it was very de minimis. It's nothing like today. It's not the same thing. I don't think, in my opinion.
Well, no, it's not the same thing. But also, this is going to profoundly affect high schools.
It already is.
It's going to. It used to be the only way you were going to make, even colleges that were giving players money under the table weren't giving them tons of money. They might give them enough money. Like once, what some colleges would do is okay. One of our boosters runs a car dealership. You're going to have a summer job working at the car dealership. I'm putting that in air quotation marks. And then you get the use of a car. But nobody was making a ton of money. Now you're having players going into the transfer portal who are getting signed to big money.
Oh, yeah.
You can now make big money and never play in the NFL at all.
And that's what I mean. So it's a competing pro league.
Yeah, and so
it's dicey the way it works because they, you know, in the old days you could get things too. Like, well, your aunt's going to get the car, and then you're going to be allowed to use it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, those kinds of things would go on. And if you remember, the FBI was doing stings on a few years back, and so the numbers were in the hundreds of thousands, not the millions. Right now, the schools have the ability to directly pay their athletes, and the fund is. Last year it was $20.5 million. It's going to go up. This is part of that most recent court settlement. That's what they can do directly.
Kevin, is this every sport included or just football?
All of them. So, like, if you look at Notre Dame, football's getting the lion's share of that, and then basketball sort of gets the scraps. I would imagine if you go to Duke, you will find that Duke basketball is getting a whole hell of a lot more than Notre Dame basketball is getting out of that 25.
What if you're DePaul or Loyola and don't have a football team? You still get the $20 million.
I believe that's true. Yes.
Wow.
So they can really do well in basketball. What I'm saying though is then the rest of it's all third party stuff, and the schools get involved in arranging it. But then do you have a deal with Under Armour? Do you have a deal with Nike? Do you have a deal with Red Bull and, you know, all those kinds of things? That's, you know, and what has happened is a lot of in the recruiting process that Eric described, the portal recruiting process, a lot of schools have made promises that I can arrange for you to have this third-party money as well. And in some cases, it has fallen through. In some cases, it hasn't passed muster with the NCAA because it has to be, it has to pass the smell test in terms of what are you doing for that compensation? It has to, you know, it has to be sort of in kind. And as a result, you know, you're finding some very disappointed players when they get there and they find out, well, it's not quite what you promised.
Is that what happened to the guy at UNLV?
You have the school scrambling to find
it.
That's what happened to the guy at UNLV, right, Kevin?
I think that was similar, but I don't know that that was exactly the same. I don't know. I don't know if that was the same because they didn't have the third-party rule at the time.
Yeah, and what's happening also is, you know, you got some a college. I mean, some college coaches are saying, "I'm not even going to look at high school players. I'm just I'm going to start restocking my team through the portal, or so you can, you know, you can." Decide, I'm going to go to this college, and even you get a scholarship, but then you get there, and then they sign some guy who's already a junior or a senior, and you realize that they're just going to keep doing this. And you might never, unless you, of course, can get some playing time and then get into the portal yourself and go somewhere. But this is really going. This is really affecting high schools in that way, and it's affecting high schools in the way of
Eric. When now, do you think
You can now make a significant amount of money, and I can't emphasize this enough. You can make a significant amount of money now, and you don't necessarily have to play in the NFL
without it. Eric, what do you think? When do you think, if it already hasn't? Maybe this is a Mr. Flanagan question. If you and I are the four of us, the both of us to the four of us, if we're recruiting for Notre Dame or anybody, to sign some college kid or high school kid up, what do you think it costs in private jets and everything else to go find the kid? It's got to be $60,000-$100,000 a kid to recruit.
If it's someone you really, really want, I mean, we've heard stories of coaches basically making 2 and 3 trips to sit down with the parents and
one of our friends at the
try to talk them into coming to there. But now one of the things is students looking at it as the college I sign on to go to, I'm not necessarily going to stay there.
That's my question.
For the whole time that I play, I'm going to stay there, showcase my talents, and if some other school comes along and offers me a truckload of money to go to their school, I'm going to jump and go to that.
Well, how long are the four of us going to be idiots and sign the kid up to a 1-year deal and not a 4-year deal? I mean, why would anybody in a college at this point recruit some kid from high school, spend all that money to get him there, pay him, get him an agreement, and then if he gets a better deal after 1, why isn't that a 4-year deal?
That's why some colleges aren't looking at high school players the way they
You know, you mentioned high schools. You guys, one of my
But I will tell you, there's different approaches because Ohio State is looking at a lot of high school players. They're bringing in a lot of high school players. Notre Dame is. Marcus Freeman, you know, is the transfers are just to fill in the blanks where they need them, and they aren't losing many players leaving the program. They lose some because there's some guys that look and say, "I'm never going to get much playing time here, and I got 2 years left. I want to go have a chance to showcase." So we talked about Pat Coogan last year at Indiana. He wasn't going to start at Notre Dame. He did get to start at Indiana. That's the difference for him, was the difference between being drafted at all and not being drafted. He was a low round pick, but he was drafted, and I'd have to check to see if he made a team.
I was going
to
say, did he make a team?
Your chances of making a team as a draft pick are way higher than as an undrafted free agent. So, I think you see a lot of that kind of thinking for the players who are looking for a longer term opportunity. And really, the only difference is because, as Eric pointed out, you can make a lot of money in college. And in many cases, as much or even more for some of these lower round draft picks, you can make that much in college versus the NFL. The difference is in the NFL, where you want to get to that, you want to get to a term contract where, you know, you're kind of paid for the next several years. And I know they're limited on guaranteed money that they do, but they do that by putting a lot of money up front in the contract. So Eric, you know, I think that's probably the biggest difference is colleges are not generally giving term contracts at this point.
Eric, you mentioned high schools in one of the odd ways, in addition to the payments. Yeah. By the way, Kevin and I have a real good friend out in California. We coach high school forever. And evidently, the money has been filtering down to high school there way ahead of when it did here. And sometimes it's with their kids are playing in these summer leagues, the flag leagues or something. But my friends here, who's actually just his term was just up as the chairman of the board of one of the Catholic high schools here. If you think your kid's a star, what do you suppose one of the biggest questions the parents ask when the kid comes to your school? Can he graduate? Can he graduate in December of his senior year? Because evidently, when colleges are recruiting you, they want you to be able to do spring practice. If they think you're that good, they want you to be in the school in January so you can do spring practice. So a freshman is not just showing up 3 weeks before camp and starting as quarterback. He's got a whole spring to practice. That's one of the big questions now is they want kids that can graduate in, you know, let's say in Christmas, their senior year, so they can already be in the school. A la O.J. Simpson was running track for Southern Cal in the spring, right?
A different take on that, Tom, is just as one example, Teddy Girard is a guy who graduated early so that he could be here because nobody thinks C.J. Carr is going to stay around longer than this season. If he has a very successful season, he's going to be a first-round draft pick in the NFL, and he'll be gone. And so everybody wants to be in line to be, all the recruits want to be in line to be C.J. Carr's replacement. And Girard actually accelerated to a year of high school just so that he could be in that competition for it.
But that was a question. I mean, I can't imagine, Kevin, I don't know what it was like at Loyola. I'll tell you what, if I would have walked into Brother Rock at Marist and say, I want to graduate in December, I probably would have had a fist sending me out the front door. I mean, the thought of even doing that. Wait a minute, who the hell do you think you are?
I had a classmate who did. He did that, and he enrolled in college a year, for the spring term.
Really? You go to summer school or something? Well, okay. Hey, guys, we got a dash. S&P futures up 75 cents, NASDAQ futures down 70. Not much stocks today because nothing's going on. It's a week. We're going to wait and see if the Treasury Department does more because things are kind of back where they were when they did something a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. I don't know if they will or they won't, but obviously that's going to jar the markets one way or the other. I'm trying to position my people to be as unjarrable as possible, if that's possible, guys. How can that be unjarrable? And it's a how's that for? Eric, hope to see you soon. Kevin, I hope everything's all right over on your end. John,
yeah,
thank
by the
you.
Way, yeah, Coogan did make the Tennessee Titans.
Well, he did make the Titans? Good.
Yeah.
You're at Kevin? You're at Kevin
okay,
Coogan
yep,
made the
Titans.
I
heard that. So,
well, good for him.
Hey, Eric, nice catching up to you. It's been a long time.
Yeah,
so.
I know.
We're
And I think I crowded John out, so I feel terrible about that. But I was supposed to be on 90 minutes before I was.
John was lurking. He likes to lurk sometimes. He's a lurker, kind of guy. We all know lurker kind of guys. But anyway, thank you, John, because John saved me early because I was doing too much of a monologue, Kevin. But fortunately, I was on with Joel yesterday, so I just kind of repeated some of the stuff I said there. They asked me some questions that people don't normally ask. But it's different when you're the questionee versus the questioner. It's interesting. Anyway, guys, thank you. Back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
All right. Bye.
That's all, folks.